The Gospel Plan of Salvation by T.W. Brents. Chapter 11, The Confession. It is very generally admitted that some sort of confession of something should be made by everyone at some time prior to admission into the Church of God. But what this confession is, how and when it should be made, and its office in the plan of salvation are questions which have greatly perplexed those who have spoken and written concerning them for the past 300 years. In the early ages of the Church, persons were required to confess with the mouth their faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God prior to baptism, and the only question worthy of our consideration at present is whether or not this practice was authorized by inspired precept or example. Paul says, "All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works." 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. If the man of God is authorized to require the confession to be made by anyone, surely it is a good work. And if a good work, the Scriptures thoroughly furnish the man of God to it. That is, they thoroughly furnish the man of God with all needful instructions concerning it. If he is not therein thoroughly furnished to it, then it follows that it is not a good work and should be abandoned. It may be well, then, for us to examine the divine volume and see whether or not it furnishes authority for such a practice. When the Ethiopian nobleman demanded baptism at the hands of Philip, the inspired teacher said, "If thou believest with all thy heart, thou mayest." And he answered and said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." Acts chapter 8 and verse 32. That this was the proper confession is evident from the fact that it was satisfactory to the man of God, who thereupon proceeded at once to baptize him. And that it should be made after faith is evident from the fact that it would have been false had not the faith preceded it. And that it should be made before baptism is evident from the fact that it was demanded as a condition precedent to baptism. Here, then, we learn what is to be confessed, that is, that "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God," and that the time to make it is after faith and before baptism. While this verse is regarded as genuine, the question of authority for this confession is not debatable at all. Here is a plain, unmistakable precedent which we dare not ignore. Our practice must conform to it, or the passage must be removed from the divine volume. But we are told that the passage is spurious, an interpolation which constitutes no part of the sacred text. While our limits will not allow us to enter upon an extensive examination of the claims of this verse, nor have the means afforded us been such as to enable us to decide the matter, even to our own satisfaction, we are by no means satisfied that the proofs offered by those who would set it aside are conclusive. Indeed, we are not quite sure that there is, at this day, a possibility of knowing with certainty that it is spurious. This narrative, the Acts, like all the other books of the New Testament, was at first a separate manuscript and was circulated by being copied by uninspired men. These copies were again copied, and copies of copies were copied. How far from the original, we have no means of knowing. The first copy taken was in all probability imperfect, as it is very difficult to copy anything without imperfections. And these imperfections must have increased as the copies were more remote from the original, because each copy must contain the errors of the one from which it was taken, with the chance of incorporating others. As the only sure method of correcting these errors was to compare copies with the original, when it wore out, we see not how any further corrections could have been made. That the original manuscript and all copies taken directly from it have long since been worn out is next to certain. How, then, are the claims of the verse in question to be settled? Were it wanting in all manuscripts of the first 1,000 years and only found in such as are of modern date, this would be a circumstance well calculated to cast suspicion upon it. But Dr. Hackett tells us that this interpolation was known to Irenaeus as early as the year 170. Then it was bound to have been in copies taken at or before that period. It is fair to presume that the original and all the first copies were circulated among and read and handled by thousands of persons, and hence were most likely worn out before that time, so that we are not sure that even Irenaeus had the privilege of comparing such copies as he saw with the original, so as to be assured that it was spurious. Hence, unless Dr. Hackett would furnish us with the testimony upon which Irenaeus based his judgment, we cannot accept it as conclusive. Tregelles tells us that this verse was inserted by Erasmus as being supposed to have been incorrectly omitted in his manuscripts, and from his edition this and similar passages have been perpetuated just as if they were undoubtedly genuine. Are we to understand by this that the interpolation began with Erasmus? If so, how could Irenaeus have known of it so early as AD 170, more than 1,200 years before the time Erasmus lived? It occurs to us that those who would set aside this verse should harmonize their testimony, for when it is so plainly inconsistent, we are inclined to reject it all. The circumstance which casts the darkest shade upon the purity of the verse is the fact that the most profound critics, whose opportunities have been best for examining the subject and whose peculiar labors call them directly into examination, have decided against it. Tregelles tells us that no part of this verse is recognized in critical texts. While the version of the New Testament put forth by the American Bible Union retains the verse, the translators have appended a footnote saying, "It is wanting in the best authorities." As it was their object to give the English reader a pure version of the mind of the Spirit, we see not why they retained the verse at all, if satisfied that it was spurious. Anderson has excluded the verse from his version of the New Testament, and many other men of great research have pronounced it an interpolation. But as far as we have been able to determine the grounds of their decision, we regard them as inconclusive, and we think that attacks upon a verse that has had a place in the Bible according to the testimony of its opposers since the year 170, more than 1,700 years, should be very cautiously made, lest, unfortunately, we shake the confidence of the uninformed in the whole Bible. Were this verse inconsistent with the sense of the context, we might give more credit to attacks upon its purity. On the contrary, as it is not only in harmony with the context, but indispensable to a completion of the sense, we insist that a presumption is created in its favor. And we wish to call attention to what we think is plain to the most ordinary reader, that there is evidently a blank in the narrative without the 37th verse. We quote from Anderson's version of the New Testament, in which the verse is omitted. "And as they went along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, 'See, here is water. What hinders me from being immersed?' And he commanded the chariot to stand still, and they both went down into the water, both Philip and the eunuch, and he immersed him." Now, please observe that when they came to water, the eunuch asked a question, saying, "See, here is water. What hinders me from being immersed?" And to this important question, his inspired instructor makes no answer whatever. None. He knew that Jesus, in the very commission which authorized the act about to be performed, said, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." And when asked what hindered baptism, he made no answer at all, but acting upon the presumption that the eunuch believed, proceeded to baptize him without asking whether he believed or not. And stranger still, the eunuch commanded the chariot to stand still and got out of it without knowing whether Philip would baptize him or not. Are we to believe that Philip said nothing in answer to the question? And yet the eunuch commanded the chariot to be still, that both got out of it and went down into the water in silence. Can any sane man believe it? Is there not a perceivable blank which the sense requires to be filled with just such language as we find in the verse in question? We cannot pursue the subject further, but dismiss it with the remark that the verse is fairly deducible from the connection, and it will require stronger proof than we have yet seen to shake our confidence in its purity. But whether it be real or spurious, the confession can be justified by other scriptures, the authenticity of which will not be called in question by any believer in the inspiration of the Bible. upon the banks of the Jordan, in the presence of the multitude that waited upon the ministry of John, God bore witness to the divine character and mission of his Son, saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Matthew chapter 3, verse 17. Upon the truth of the grand proposition that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, rests the salvation of the world, and in it are centered all the hopes which mortals can have that reach beyond the grave. It underlies the whole scheme of man's redemption. For if he be not the Son of God, he was an impostor. The Bible is a fable, and no man was, is, or ever will be under obligations to believe in or obey him. On the contrary, if this is true, his pretensions were real, his claims are just, and every man who professes to believe it puts himself under obligation to accept the terms he imposes. Hence Jesus said, Whosoever shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I also deny before my Father which is in heaven. Matthew chapter 10, verse 33. Here he gives us plainly to know the importance of confessing him before men. But how did they confess him? When the parents of the blind man whose eyes were opened by Jesus were questioned, they feared the people, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was the Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. John chapter 9, verse 22. Then to confess him was to confess that he was the Christ, and to deny him was to deny that he was the Christ. Of course, some were making this confession, and others denying it, or the Jews would not have made such an agreement concerning those who did make it. These sayings among the people may have given rise to the question which Jesus asked his disciples, saying, Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Matthew chapter 16 and verse 13. In answer to this question, the disciples gave some of the opinions which the people expressed concerning him when he put the question directly to them, saying, Whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Matthew 16, verses 15 and 16. Here the same grand truth is confessed by Peter, and Jesus assures him that on it his church is to be built, as much as to say, All my claims upon the world rest upon this truth which you have now confessed, not because you have confessed it, but because it is true. You could not have known it had not my Father, at my baptism, and at the transfiguration, and also through the mighty works I have done in his name, in your presence, revealed it to you. All who confess it put themselves under obligations thereby to accept the terms and obligations I impose, as much as if God, who sent me, did himself impose them. Hence I will make this truth the foundation of my church. By making this confession, the party puts himself under the strongest possible obligations to observe all the ordinances emanating from Jesus as head of the church built upon the truth confessed. Hence John says, Whosoever shall confess that Jesus is the Son of God, God dwelleth in him, and he in God. 1 John chapter 4, verse 15. And again, Who is he that overcometh the world, but he that believeth that Jesus is the Son of God? 1 John chapter 5 and verse 15.